This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's morning. Midweek. Yes, it is. It's Wednesday, the 8th of August, and we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. Of course, for many of us, midweek is an unexceptional time of the week, but just signals the oncoming weekend.
But the date today is really chante. It's 080818, guys.
Yeah, very ong for Chinese. Yeah, no. It.
Oh. What do you do with the 1-8 though? Is that
we ignore the one out of convenience?
As long as there's an 8 in there somewhere.
Okay, so you don't have to wait for the year 2008 and 2088
or 3008.
And 3008. Yeah. Okay, all those are possibilities. Yes, a very auspicious day indeed. Now, around the world, of course, not reflecting that is the fact that war and mayhem continues. As well as natural disasters. We've had the earthquake in Indonesia, in Lombok, and now there's a fire in California, which experts say will burn for the rest of August.
Wow. So for the next month, there's going to be the wildfires will continue to burn. I mean, this is just coming off Greece, isn't it? Greece had massive fires there as well.
Mm-hmm. And followed by flooding.
Oh, no.
They did. This fire is larger than the state of New York. Apparently, it's 45%. The area in question that's burning is larger than 45% larger than the state of New York. It's a huge area because California itself, perhaps for many of us who don't know the American continent, it's a huge area.
That's right. Yeah, and so you've got these wildfires that are raging on the west coast of the United States. And then over on the east coast, there's plenty of flooding there as well. Talk about extremes, because I've got plenty of Facebook updates from my friends in my college town in Virginia. And there's news of dams breaking.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
Yeah, and it was covered on the BBC as well.
And so how can we still have climate change deniers in this day and age?
We do indeed. You know, very interesting. The trauma that individuals suffer as a consequence of this. A friend of mine, his brother was an architectural historian. His collection of over 10,000 factories. These were factories from the 19th century. And he had been documenting them. His entire slide collection, his documentation, went up in smoke in one of these fires in California. Mm-hmm. He has since become an expert on earthquakes. So he now, as an architect, looks at buildings that survive earthquakes. So he took his trauma from the destruction of his life's work into a new direction.
A new career.
My goodness.
A new career.
Just to come back very quickly to the California fire, right? So there's the fire is called the Mendocino Fire. That's one fire. There's a separate blaze called the Carr Fire. Now, it's not known how the Mendocino blaze started, but the Carr Fire was actually started from a flat tire. Apparently, a spark created from the wheel hitting the asphalt back in July created a deadly fire, and it was raging for more than 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, because you hear this, this is an annual occurrence, right? No, I think a couple of years ago, it was someone who just threw a lit cigarette butt while out camping, and that sparked that massive wildfire as well. Obviously, not to the extent that we're seeing right now in the state of California.
I mean, a lit cigarette butt feels very irresponsible, but the tire hitting the asphalt being dry and hot conditions that created a forest fire is astounding to me.
Yeah. Even in the Greek situation, it was seen as humans who started it, and probably started. Now, speaking about changes in careers without trauma, you have Usain Bolt. He's in the news because the 8-time Olympic champion, he's a runner, of course, in athletics, he's thinking of moving into football. So he's going to be training with an Australian football team.
Yeah, look, he's a very well-known football fan. He's a fan of Manchester United, so I am in good company here. Thank you very much. Obviously, not having the chops to make it in the Premier League, so he's now training his sights on the Australian.
Okay,
league.
So I know nothing about the skills required to play football. So I take it you need to have the stamina to withstand the length of the game. But is that all you need to be able to run up and down the pitch?
Well, clearly not. I mean, you have to dribble and you have to have a sense of strategy. But the thing is, Usain Bolt actually believes, I mean, he's only in his early 30s and he retired from athletics some years ago. He believes that football could be his next thing. And so, you know, he's putting a lot of effort into doing it.
So meaning football, you can be older and play football?
Yeah, well, so the A-League in Australia is where Premier League stars who have age, or even European players who have age, kind of go and, you know, see out the rest of their careers. And that's where they have a lot of fun. So Dwight York actually went to Sydney. And when I was in Sydney, he was like known to be this party animal in Sydney. You know, because he knows, you know, the clock is ticking down on him and just
Dwight
having fun.
What now?
Dwight York.
The clock is ticking for all of us.
That's right.
Including Winnie the Pooh
York.
In China and the BBC. Both have been blocked. So that's a story that we could come back to. But yeah, well, there we have it. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Otis Redding with The Happy Song. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han. And it's just coming up to 9 minutes past six in the morning. Australia, land of milk and honey for many Malaysians who have migrated there.
That's true.
In search of greener pastures, have gone to a continental size country, which has a very small population. But that population recently hit 25 million, and some people are complaining.
I didn't realize that Australia had a population 25. I mean, so technically Malaysia has more, right? So we're what, 30, 31, 32, yes? 32 million people. So Australia being the size that it is, for 25 million people, it's really not that many people if you think about it. And yet, hitting this population milestone of 25 million people has actually magnified a debate in Australia as to whether people want a big Australia or a little Australia, given that most of this population is driven by migration.
That's right. So it is a pretty comparative story, because if you look at Malaysia's numbers, the number of citizens is about 29 million. All right, we hit that 32 million mark because of the number of non-citizens. That number is in at about 3.3 million or so. Okay, so with Australia, right, on one hand, you have, say, the economic benefits. Australia's economy has the world's longest growth. So in other words, they have been able to avoid
a recession. Yeah.
Right? Why? Because their population actually grew by 50% over the past three decades.
You know, if you want to put this into perspective, you can actually go back a long, long time. A book I read many years ago about Australia was by a guy called Tim Flannery, and it's called The Future Eaters. And it really talks, what it does is, it's the ecological history of Australia. It talks about the emergence of human beings on the continent and how they competed with the large marsupials.
Oh, so my God, he's going way back.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's that old, people.
Yeah, you know, and that competition led to the extinction of large animals on the continent, and this story, of course, continues into the present because of the introduction of non-native species, both plants and animals, that have had a consequence. So even though Australia looks large, it could still be a fragile environment. I think that's something that people forget. Mm. So the numbers don't tell you the entire story. There is a level of fragility in ecosystems, and their sustainability can be in question.
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, most of the center of that island is desert, right? And the livable areas are along the coast. So people still gravitate towards the Sydneys and the Melbournes, and perhaps shy away from the Tasmanias and whatnot. And the latest numbers show as well. So while at the same time, top line growth for the economy has been great, they've been able to stave off a recession, but it also comes at a cost. Cost being, say, those runaway house prices that you see in Australia, you know, the overburdened infrastructure, transportation, even low wage growth, because you've got more people entering the workforce. You know, there is less pressure on the supply of the workforce, so wage growth is dampened as well.
So are some Australian sentiments about being concerned of this kind of migration, mass migration, or the growth in population, is that warranted? I mean, are they right in wanting for a smaller Australia?
Well, yeah, whether or not they're right, I don't know, but it was very...
It becomes this xenophobia, you know, the feeling of okay, so our culture is being diluted by the presence of migrants or foreign workers or foreigners. And I do think that, you know, as you just said, Australia had benefited from having this influx of a working population come into their borders.
Well, the question is how far you want to go back, right? So who gets to say...
Marsupials.
Yeah, the marsupials, why not? I mean, if the land could speak, it would say, well, you invaded us, you human beings, plus the non-native population, flora and fauna, cattle in, you know, and other kind of large animals, grazing animals, actually destroy the earth, right? Because they trample on the earth in particular ways. So, you know, depends who you ask. The native Aboriginal population can say it was white settlers that were the invaders. I mean, who's to say? When do you start framing that question?
Yeah, so that's the x-axis, right? You know, how far back do you want to go? But then you take a look at the y-axis, it's also how far down you want to go. Yeah, sure, GDP growth, top-line figures, you know, looks great, but then, or at least resilient, but then down for the average Aussie, whatever that term means, they are not seeing it. I still say this, I spent over 7 years in the Bible Belt of America, and I spent a year in Sydney. I encountered more overtly racist sentiment towards me in the Sydney CBD more so than 7 years in.
Why do you think that is?
Well, again, is this they see this massive influx of non-Caucasian people coming in, and we are blamed for taking the jobs, although I kind of did contribute to that because I took a job away from someone else in KPMG, so there we go.
Well, okay, so when foreigners come in, they often go, as you mentioned, Han, they go to the urban areas, right? The sprawling cities of Melbourne and Sydney and all that. How do you get it to be a bit more diverse or spread out? How do you encourage people to move out of the cities? Because clearly, you know, there's a lot of space in Australia, even minus the desert.
Well, I think Australia does have a policy that suggests that if you want to come in, you might have to spend some time in, say, rural Australia, if you're a doctor, for instance, and whatnot. But, you know, this is a problem in many countries, not just Australia.
Singapore has this problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Singapore there, it's other Asians not just taking jobs, it's also other Asians, you know, lording it over the local population, driving their, you know, Ferraris and Porsches and such. So, natives always have this problem about newcomers. I think that is the dynamic. Whatever you put into the native category or the newcomer category, there's always this tension, it seems. Tell us what you think. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sly and the Family Stone with If You Want Me to Stay. I'm Sherrod Kutin, and perhaps I'm not staying for very much longer. Oh. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han.
So that song was dedicated for Sherrod's last day on air with us today. And, you know, you'll see that throughout the morning, we're going to play all of songs dedicated to Sherrod's last
day. Yeah, regardless of whether I like the songs or not. But this one, Sly and the Family Stone, I really do like the song.
It's a great tune.
Yeah. Okay. We have a new government, and along with it, we have new initiatives. And it seems life, business as usual, at least in terms of governance, it will stop. But there are other aspects of our lives that perhaps we want not to be changed and not to be touched by government intervention. Many of us, or some of us, have a like, as you call it, or a desire to play games of chance. And lotteries are a prime example of that. And they want their chance to for lotteries to continue. But I believe some initiatives are afoot to change that.
That's right. So yesterday, the Minister of Finance announced that these special draws by these number forecast operators, and by numbers forecast operators, think Magnum, Sports Toto, etc., those special draws will be reduced starting next year. So the idea is that, you know, this is to curb this vice and to perhaps reduce the temptation when it comes to people perhaps waddling into some financial trouble.
So reducing the special draw, meaning reducing the pool or the how much you
times
win?
You can do.
Yeah,
do
so, oh, so like they will have special draws throughout the year, like, you know, like on a Tuesday or a Thursday, right? So these special draws are set to be reduced, at least from what I understand.
You know,
because I'm not a gambler,
right? So there was a conversation in Singapore around the establishment of casinos in the city-state, right? And the issue was public policy issues versus the business imperatives of having, you know, these large resorts with casinos. And one of the ways in which the government, I think, dealt with concerns over people developing a gambling habit, though I think it already existed, was to create institutions and agencies that would monitor this and help people with a gambling habit. So instead of saying no gambling, uh-huh. they say, well, allow gambling because that's your choice and that's, in fact, great for the economy. But we also put in place opportunities, safeguards.
But you know, speaking about the safeguards, so it's not just the counselling and the agencies to monitor, right, Shira? They make it more difficult for Singaporeans to enter into casino. You have to pay, if I'm not mistaken. You have to. There are certain restrictions.
I mean, pay, yeah, but you know, if you've been to one of these casinos as I have, you will see, and I just watched, you will see that many of the people there come in flip-flops. So they aren't people necessarily with lots of money. They're
James Bond? Is it, in my head, it's James Bond.
No, they're not wearing tuxedos? Bow ties, okay. And yeah. The women are not wearing minks, okay? So it's just a lot of what seems like older men in flip-flops and shorts. It's very unseemly. I mean, it's a very unclassy environment. Yeah. I can tell you that much.
I agree with you. I concur. I was, I encountered that same scene as well when I went to the Genting Casino just to watch, right? And yeah, it was just these individuals with pouches slung over their shoulder and whatnot with all these wads of cash.
I think you mean the ponchos.
Yeah.
Slung over their belts.
Yeah, right. But then also, I mean, just to bring it back to the Malaysian context and, you know, the rationale for the previous government, the Barisan National Government, to establish these special draws in 1999, this was to raise funds for the government to battle the Nipah virus outbreak. So it is a revenue generator for the fiscal coffers as well. In fact, it tripled from the amount collected in 1999, it was about 80 million or so, to about 238 or almost 240 million ringgit in 2017.
Right, so the idea is that you take something that is considered a sin. It's not a crime, it's just a sin. It's something that perhaps society doesn't want to encourage or some religions might frown upon, and channel into something that's good.
Welfare, social welfare.
So it's kind of like moral laundering.
like a Robin Hood of sorts.
Yeah, you take the money from something bad and put it into something good. It comes out smelling squeaky clean. Does it work? I mean, does that logic work for you?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, look, so, I mean, for me, right, it's the idea of individuals and their behavior, and at what point does the government find the rationale to intervene?
Oh, right? Step in and kind of regulate what is normal human behavior.
Right, and what is normal or what's appropriate, okay. Right? So if these individuals say, again, this is not a justification, but it's the moral rationale or even the mental rationale, right? But where do you actually find that line? Where do you draw that line between, okay, you know, draws on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, that's acceptable, but those extra draws, not acceptable.
Oh, okay. So I see it as, yes, you know, I do think that the government is right to kind of step in for curbing, I think, what they expect to be, you know, if it's a runaway social ill without any intervention. But I think the argument is, you know, whether this is a nanny state. It's the same as the government saying, well, there's a sugar tax. You shouldn't be eating too much sugar because of non-communicable diseases that arise, and that will burden the state at the end of the day. So this is, for me, in my head, the same kind of lines of a nanny state. But I'm not opposed to that.
Well, you know, I must say, I personally am opposed to the nanny
state. You are? I know you
are. Partly because I grew up in Singapore, and I can see how state intervention into your private life can be justified on almost every count, including who you marry, how you marry, who you love, what you eat, and so on and so forth. Because the government can say, well, okay, what you put into your mouth and, you know, how unhealthy you want to be has
an impact on
taxpayers, right? And so, but is that a sufficient basis for the government to intervene in your life and take control? Because if you allow that logic to operate, they can basically
slope. Yeah.
It is in fact a slippery slope to Singapore. I mean, I think that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, look, every society will have to draw their respective lines, right? Be it, say, you know, the acceptable age or drinking or marriage or, you know, in this case, gambling, right? So I guess this is a discussion that we have to continue in this Malaysia Baru.
I'd like to thank our producer, Timothy Kung, for the next song. Jeff Buckley with Last Goodbye, taking us to the first bulletin of the morning, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, ELO with Last Train to London. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris, and taking the last train to Klang, Tan Chung Han.
Actually, you're taking the last train out of BFM today.
That's true,
and
true.
We will miss you. Thank you so much for everyone weighing in on Twitter and your WhatsApps, wishing Sharad all the best on his last day and his future endeavours, as they say. Always write in your...
Thank you very much.
...in your guestbook, right? Yes, all the best in your future endeavours.
And Sharad Kutin's on the train to God knows where.
Joe Barry, my hometown.
Oh, really?
I will be back. Now, you know, we were talking earlier about... government intervention in our lives and whether it should affect, say, things like gambling habits that people have. Now there is a proposal from a minister suggesting that he's developing guidelines for Sharia-compliant clothing for the private sector. So this is for women who profess the religion of Islam, but in the private sector.
All right. So the Labour Department under the Human Resource Ministry will negotiate with the private sector to formulate these guidelines on allowing Sharia-compliant clothing at work. I think this was a coming off comments made by the Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of Islamic Affairs, Datuk Mujahid Rawa.
How do I talk about this?
I am quite Sharia compliant today. I think I've got all the bits covered that are necessary to be covered to allow me to work in a professional manner. I really don't understand what my clothing has to do with my ability to execute my job well.
And also, Sharad, you know, it's telling that automatically we looked at Melissa as being the primary demographic that will be affected by these guidelines. Yeah. So why is it only women?
I was going to say victim, but
well,
no.
Okay, So why only the ladies and not the men?
Yeah, what about you guys? What about your dress code? Why is no one policing your dress code? Sharad Kutin, are you Sharia compliant today? I don't know. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I think I am because going by some of the posters I've seen about what men have to cover up if they profess the religion of Islam, I think I kind of do it. But the issue here is the difference between being compliant to professional standards, you know, how a journalist might dress or how somebody in a bank might dress, as opposed to something that is about religion and those demands. Because those demands coming from various religious traditions might differ greatly from the professional demands. So Mujahid's attempt to impose a religious framework on a professional setting, that is kind of disturbing because you'd think in this day and age, meaning in the early days of Pakatan Harapan government, why is this a priority?
Right. And I will be fair to the federal government of the day, right?
How can you be fair with this, though? Okay, there is no way to be fair with this.
Hey, it's what I do, all right? So we don't know what these guidelines actually entail or, you know, how they will enforce it or if it's something that's enforceable, like, you know, the private sector must adhere to these guidelines or else, well, then you wouldn't call it guidelines. So it's that phrase, right? Guidelines, what does it entail? Also, Melissa, a phrase that you use, you know, like covering up the bits that you need to. So that's subjective as well, you know, say at a radio station like BFM, it's a lot more liberal, right? But perhaps in a bank or if you're a client, so you're in a client service role, client facing role, then those bits would differ.
Well, I'm
right?
sure there are already, you know, there's an implicit dress code, implicit or explicit dress code already as part of offices.
Sure.
It's not like people are rocking up in bikinis at a bank. You know what I'm saying?
Hey,
I don't understand why this has to be a priority. If you want to talk about guidelines and enforcing policy that help women in the workplace, what about the 30% policy, right? I mean, shouldn't we be focusing on things like that rather than policing dress codes?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the gender parity when it comes to pay.
Exactly.
These should. But he is the minister in charge of religious affairs. And this is one of the problems of government, right? As soon as you have a minister in charge of religious affairs, he's going to have to find work for himself. You know, he either can go with what his predecessor did, or he can redefine it. And this, unfortunately, is the impulse, I think, of all politicians, is to constantly say something so they can keep their faces in the media and keep it visible. So was it necessary? I mean, I think a lot of Malaysians would like to see the question of child marriages addressed first and foremost in a decisive way before we start policing women's dressing.
Sure.
I would like to venture that at least from my part of the demographic, this is the priority.
If you want to police my dressing, then I want to police your dressing. So tit for tat.
Whoa. Absolutely. So, Mujahid Rawal, you're going to be sent a memo very shortly with about how you should dress according to Melissa Idris.
Fashion police.
Yeah, infographics and labelings all included.
Color coded.
Okay, tell us what you think. You can tweet us at BFM Radio or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Kinks with This Time Tomorrow. I'm Sharad Kutin, and This Time Tomorrow, I won't be anchoring. Aww. Instead, Melissa Idris or Tan Chung Han will be doing the anchoring.
Well, we'll be in tomorrow.
Well,
he
will be fast asleep, rubbing it in our faces.
I will be, though. I think I will get up. I think I'm going to make it a habit to get up with the sun. I think getting up in the morning, early in the morning, is something I hated to do all my life, but I've learned to come to love as a result of working on the morning run. So, yeah, I'll be up and listening to you guys.
Oh, wonderful. Just don't write in with nasty comments. But thank you, everyone, for writing in with your great comments this morning. I just want to give a shout out to Ravi Kumar, who he wrote in a reference to our earlier conversation about policing or enforcing a Sharia compliant dress code for the private sector. Now, he says, instead of wanting to decide and offer the so-called guidelines on clothing, we need a back-to-school detention for foul-mouthed MPs. And a quick note from also from Aris Nazman, who says that the guidelines he believes, or she believes, would be for women who are discriminated in not being selected for jobs like stewardess because they cover up. I do think we have to make a distinction, though. The dress code guidelines, separate from discrimination at the workplace. There are two separate issues, right? Discrimination in the workplace, we can tackle separately without having to enforce or police a dress code.
Right. But I think the underlying principle here, okay, while I'm inclined to give these lawmakers the benefit of the doubt, but, as an individual personally, my bias is whereby, the government intervention should be less rather than more. Especially with the private sector, you should, let good old market dynamics dictate how they go about their business. Now, let's say this particular business decides to not follow Sharia compliant dressings, and then say the workforce or the customers then withhold their business from that business because of that decision, then that's how they can be punished. That requires less government intervention rather than more. Mm-hmm. But again, willing to give them the benefit of the doubt to see what these guidelines actually entail.
The problem with guidelines, even though they are guidelines and not laws and strictly enforced, is that they open up the possibility for increased demands for such conservative social agendas, right? Whether it's at a national level or whether it's at the enterprise level. Because what the minister is signaling, right, it's kind of what they call a dog whistle, right? It's something you don't hear on the surface, but it's being signaled that, in fact, this government is willing to push through socially conservative policies and agendas in the interest of one segment of the society. And I mean that as the conservative segment of society. That is what Mujahid Rawal is doing, whether intentionally or inadvertently, he's doing that.
Yeah, so even in response to addressing the discrimination about wearing hijabs in the workplace or in certain professions.
Right, but this is where we can be reminded that we have the power. In this Malaysia Baru, we then push back. This can be seen as a litmus test of whether or not the Pakatan Harapan government is responsive to our voices. Now, if there's a sizable enough pushback against such guidelines, and if they respond to it, great, democracy is well and alive. Now, if they then steamroll it through, then you kind of have a better idea about where the federal government is today.
Sure. I do want to, you know, kind of address the comments that we're getting on social media, on Twitter and on WhatsApp, talking about how, you know, most of the people weighing in saying that, well, the comments from the minister was actually to address the discrimination about, you know, some officers or some companies not allowing staff to wear tudung or to cover up. But again, coming back to Sharad's point, it is a slippery slope. You open that door and then it allows for more policing, more, you know. So addressing the discrimination at work can be done without enforcing a dress code.
And that's a conversation we'll continue. Remember, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. We'll come back to the question of governance. It's not business as usual. In fact, one of the most surprising things that's happened in recent times is that a member of the federal opposition has been elected to the to head the parliamentary select committee. That's just one of the many things happening. One of the things we did anticipate was, in fact, for the federal opposition, now the Barisan Nasional, to have a shadow cabinet. But instead of that, what the opposition leader Ahmad Zahid Hamidi has said is that the opposition will not form a shadow cabinet, but will create or allocate portfolios to his MPs to focus on specific subjects. And this is what he had to say.
Tetapi kita telah menyusun senarai ahli-ahli parlimen dari pembangkang yang mewakili UMNO dan PAS terutamanya untuk diberikan tanggungjawab memfokuskan portfolio tertentu. Dan tentunya perbahasan-perbahasan menjurus kepada bidang masing-masing dan ini akan menyebabkan fokus diberikan kepada ahli-ahli parlimen tertentu untuk membahaskan dan membangkitkan perkara tertentu. Namun, mereka juga diberikan kebebasan berdasarkan latar belakang untuk menyentuh lain-lain perkara kerana kita berjanji untuk menjadi pembangkang yang konstruktif.
That was opposition leader Ahmad Zahid Hamidi, UMNO MP for Bagan Datuk.
Okay, so essentially he's saying that all these ministers will have a beat. Right? So whatever, like a journalist, you know, whatever your specialty is, you have a beat and then that's what you're going to cover and you learn that topic in and out and then you become good at it. I think that's great, right? So, you know, allocating resources efficiently. But not having a shadow cabinet, is that something that, I mean, I would say to have a strong opposition, you kind of need a shadow cabinet. I'd like for there to be a shadow cabinet. It makes me feel like there is an opposition there who keeps the current government in check.
Right. I agree, right? Because having that shadow cabinet then formalizes these so-called positions. I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, like reporters, for example, or you might have different beats, but you're just a reporter, as opposed to saying that you are the editor for the sports section, right? It formalizes it. So I think it's necessary that the Barisan Nasional, or whatever's left of the Barisan Nasional coalition, they form that shadow cabinet.
And this is actually very important, Han, what you just mentioned, because in countries like Britain, where the parties are fairly stable, right? So you have the Conservatives and you have the Labour Party, and whoever is in opposition might be able to form a shadow cabinet. I mean, there's still internal political changes and dynamics. But in a coalition situation, how do you allocate cabinet seats? Mm. How can you tell before an election, before the parties demonstrate their ability to win seats and their strength in the coalition based on their strength in the assembly, how do you allocate those cabinet positions? Because we know cabinet positions are allocated not simply on the basis of competence. They're often rewards or recognition of the electoral weight or heft of that party in that coalition. So it's going to be very complicated for them. It might be easier, as Ahmad Zahid Hamidi suggests, to just have individuals develop competencies without necessarily committing themselves to a shadow cabinet.
Well, I guess in this regard, you know, because BN has had over 60 years of experience as the ruling government, you know, so you know, they have plenty of opportunities to develop those expertise and portfolios and whatnot.
But don't you want them to have that difficult conversation? Then it will bring so much to light, right? So yes, it's going to be complicated to allocate seats in a shadow cabinet in a coalition party, but why not? Have that conversation, then you'll see what weight you bring to the party.
Right, and also because a shadow cabinet is, I mean, it doesn't come along with the perks that an official post in the cabinet has, right? So that, I think, will actually reduce or remove one extra layer of complexity whereby, you know, they might be jostling for that position because of the perks that comes with the cabinet ministry. But real quick update here. So the UMNO SecGen, Anwar Musa, has apparently said that BN would, this week, announce the members members of its shadow cabinet. So talk about a U-turn there.
Well, or maybe kind of a much more Hydra-headed type of Barisan Nasional. All speaking different things to different people. Okay, we're coming up to the next Bulletin of the Morning. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.